Well, let's come back to other matters. Japan, as we just discussed, might be perhaps the most extreme example of the demographic revolution happening in the developed economies. But did you know that in fact the whole world, with really a very few exceptions, is going grey? For the first time in history, there are now more people over 50 than younger than 17. One of China's biggest fears, as you know, is that it'll grow old before it grows rich, something that doesn't worry India. Well, the US journalist and writer Ted Fishman has explored the consequences of an ageing world, and the essential argument he makes in his new book is that big capital, which powers growth and change, will follow youth as it always has. He asserts this and a whole lot more in a new book called Shock of Grey, The Ageing of the World's Population, and how it pits young against old, child against parent, worker against boss, company against rival, and nation against nation. And Ted, the author of the longest subtitle in history, joins us now from Chicago.
Hello, hello. Maybe I should make that chapter one.
Certainly, yes, this was your choice, was it? All of those little sub descriptions?
Well, I approved it, so I share the blame. But, you know, it's a big topic, and it changes every walk of life, all of our important relationships. And, you know, if I can communicate that through the title, then I'm already
halfway there.
Part of what I want to do, yeah.
Could we, in fact, go to China? Because it's where that this trend, as with so many, is in hyper relief. In your previous book, China Inc., you describe being awed by the neon wonderlands of youth that you found there in China's cities. But when you went into the countryside, you found a very different China.
Yeah, that's absolutely so. There's nothing more irresistible in the world to a young person than an Asian city. They hum. You see people between the ages of 18 and 35 everywhere you go, on the make, walking quickly, as optimistic as can be. Of course, if you peer deeply, more deeply into the scene, there's a whole world of invisible older people, but they are not the ones who are adding a million people a year to the populations of Shanghai and Beijing. These are the young people pouring out of the countryside. And when you go from the city to the country, you often find yourself landing in villages that have no young people at all. Maybe some children who are tended to by their grandparents, but all the young people who are working age are simply gone. So much so that even sometimes the local communist committees are just made up of octogenarians alone, no one else to fill the role.
And look, what did that feel like? Because that's what I'm keen to explore with you about. Will there be a different feel around our communities as people age?
I think there is a different feel, and some of it is how we will these places to feel, and some of it is how we structure them to feel. So I'm from Chicago. Chicago is a famously racially divided city. And so when I see populations divided, the first thing I look for is what is the structural economic reason for this division? And in China, for example, they have made a decision. It's part of their industrial development plan that they will pump the young people into the factories that are being built to serve the rest of the world and keep the older people out who are still very hardworking, but not hardworking in the way the rest of the world demands, which is to say the young people will work without pensions, without health care benefits, without the safety nets that employers and investors from the rest of the developed world are looking to escape.
Does it change things like filial loyalty? That's also a very interesting thing you look at, the way in which there's a different compact sets up between the generations. How have you seen that work in China?
Well, it works in counterintuitive ways, and I think it's not just China, but in China it's in sharp relief because of the way the society is self-described as a bastion of filial loyalty, where children pay homage to their parents and support their parents in old age, and grandparents take care of children. You know, a lot of these things are a myth, and there are structures that fight against them and government policies that fight against them. So things that I found in China that were upsetting to me and well known to Chinese people is that when the physical distance separates between parent and child, where the child goes 1,500 kilometers away to work in a factory. They're expected to send money home, and they do send money home for a while, but when they plant themselves in a city that's far more expensive than the countryside they left, have their own children who need to be paid for, try and find an apartment, which in China is very expensive, often many multiples of a lifetime earning, these filial ties break down and people stop sending money home. In fact, you know, they really anathematize the older people. And you can even see this in the villages. When you go to the villages, you wonder why people have been abandoned, and they often complain quite bitterly about it.
Mm.
One of the professors I talked to at Tsinghua University, which is, you know, one of the premier universities in the country, said, you know, we have this attitude about venerating your elders, but this grew up at a time when people lived on average to be 35. It's a very convenient value to have when you don't have elders around to venerate.
Mm.
And then it was also pointed out to me that the Chinese grandmother who tells you that it's always been the job of the Chinese grandmother to take care of the grandchild so the parent can work is also a kind of myth. Traditionally in China, it was the middle generation, the sandwich generation, that took care of both the grandparents and the children. And now the economics of the country have reversed this, and it's also changed the myth of the family.
In fact, you do argue, Ted, that the aging of the world's population generally is both driving globalization and the products of it. Could you take us into your argument, please?
Sure. We live in, you know, the countries that are traditionally identified as the developed countries. They're also the most advanced in terms of how old they are demographically. Australia is certainly part of that. The U.S. is part of that. Our two countries tend to be a little bit younger than East Asia and Western Europe because of the youth of immigrants who come in, but the birth rates are still low. But we have aging workforces everywhere, and the fastest growing parts of our population are the groups that are above the average age. So 50 to 60-year-olds are growing faster than the 20 to 30-year-olds. 60 to 70-year-olds are growing faster than the 30 to 40-year-olds. And when your workforce goes through this kind of change, it means that the bulk of your workforce is also the most expensive kind of worker you can have. They get higher salaries because of their long tenures at their firms. They get more benefits, health benefits. They get more pension benefits. And they can come either directly from the firm or they can come in taxes. It all goes towards the general economy of the environment that you're working in. As the workforce ages, it's a more expensive place to do business. And businesses know this. It affects what they pay. It affects how they're taxed and everything. So if you look at the developed world, we all know that there's huge fiscal crises everywhere, that every country is trying to push up the retirement age. But if you look at the workplace itself, retirement age is going down, even as the official retirement ages go up, because there is this imperative that the employers cut their costs. So people are losing their standard lifelong employment at earlier ages than they had been.
And you think that will continue, do you? Because there could be an argument that this is just a bit of a dissonance at the moment that can't go on.
Well, I'm making an argument for how we could escape that dynamic. You know, I certainly hope we do escape it, but we need to make the decision to escape it. So at the very same time there's disemployment and the devaluing of older workers in the developing world, there's the acquisition of 100 to 200 million new workers in a globalized economy in China. All of them, virtually all of them, between the ages of 18 and 35, and most of them between the ages of 18 and 25. So going into factories, which I do often, where there are 10 or 20,000 people working at the benches, you almost never see anyone over the age of 25. So you think to yourself, what's the most essential fact about this workplace? It's the youth of the workers. They're defined by their youth. There's one company in China called Foxconn. It has 960,000 employees today. It makes iPods, Dell computers, Hewlett Packard.
This was the one that had all the suicides, wasn't it?
It had a rash of suicides. Mm. They're acquiring 400,000 more workers in the next 12 months. So their company will have 1.3 million workers, virtually all of them under the age of 25. This is a very stark demarcation of the world economy by age. And it's the aging which is causing the tide of investment, the tide of production, all of the supply chains to move. And that's how you get the globalization picture.
And are you implying, because your massive subtitle subtitle suggests this, that there's an...
I tried not to imply anything. I tried to lay it all out.
Yeah. that it implies a brewing conflict, Ted? Is that what you're suggesting, that this massive skewing of capital and investment, that this is going to cause trouble?
Yeah, I think the scenarios I just described our kind of conflict we're living with right now. That's the worker against boss conflict. It's also the nation against nation conflict. But there's another kind of conflict that's growing up, and that's the conflict within generations. So in Shock of Grey, one of the most disturbing things to me to report on was the conversion of older workers from their traditional work, their salaried work, their benefited work, to work that they're forced to take, you know, from their mid-50s on, which is very different from the work that they had. So they're pushed out of the workforce they were in, and then, in the United States at least, they're suffering the longest periods of unemployment of any age group, and when they re-enter the workforce, they re-enter in vastly reduced circumstances, forced to take between 20 and 50% less wage in jobs that have status that are far lower. So you have this conversion of a workforce from a full-value workforce to a devalued workforce. A part of the reason is because they're pitted against each other. So the boomers are very numerous, so they have to compete for each other.
Well, I'll be very interested to hear what our listeners say about this, but I just want to ask you one more very quick question. Will the world ever get young again?
I don't think so. You know, right now we have this shift of if you take a picture of the world's population and stack the different age groups, you know, for nearly all of human history, it looked like this big famous triangle, you know, with young people filling the base of the triangle and the older people narrowing to the peak of the triangle. And now this triangle is inverting so that the younger groups are a smaller part, and then the older groups keep growing older and older until you get to a very advanced age when it starts narrowing again. We're never going to have that first triangle again, I don't believe. For good reasons, and reasons what the world can benefit from, but we might have a population that looks more like a rectangle where the ages are more evenly distributed across the population.
All right, Ted. Well, thank you very much. Most provocative, and I'll thank you for your time.
Thank you. I enjoyed talking with you.
And Ted Fishman's new book is called Shock of Grey, and it's published by Scribner.